This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to the American Monetary Association's podcast, where we explore how monetary policy impacts the real lives of real people and the action steps necessary to preserve wealth and enhance one's lifestyle.
Hey, it's my pleasure to welcome a returning guest back to the show. He is an economist, an investment advisor, a prognosticator. He's got some really interesting deep insight into the economy, but mostly, more than anything else, he is a speaker at our last Venture Alliance Mastermind meeting, and that is Mish Shedlock. Mish, welcome back. How are you?
Oh, pleasure to be back on the show, Jason. What took you so long to have me back? It was a pleasure at the conference. I enjoyed it. The views at the restaurant were phenomenal, both in the afternoon and the evening. Of course, the talks and the meetings, everything was fantastic.
Well, Mish, I'm glad you enjoyed it. Yeah, you joined us for dinner on Friday evening, and then you spoke to our group on Saturday morning, and then you went out for a rather long lunch or brunch with us Saturday afternoon. And I got to tell you, and you'll have a comment about this, I am sure, but that lunch brunch we had together, the Venture Alliance Mastermind Group, and you and your lovely wife were there, one of the funny things about it, it is a lesson on dysfunctional government. Now, you all might be thinking, what is he going to say? How does his lunch or brunch with the Venture Alliance Group have anything to do with dysfunctional government? Well, I'm going to tell you. So we had a food and beverage minimum at that lunch, right? And we ate lunch and had a very nice lunch together. And the waitress comes over and tells me, you know, you've got quite a bit left on your food and beverage minimum, and you got to meet the minimum or we're going to charge you anyway. So I, in true party animal spirit, started shoving drinks down everybody's throat. And that is a lesson for dysfunctional government. Not the drinking part, although that's part of it, I'm sure, but the part about how if you don't spend your entire budget, they cut your budget down the following year. And everybody I know who is a government contractor tells me the stories of whenever these government agencies get toward the end of their fiscal year, they get tons of orders for things that the department doesn't even need. And so lunch is a metaphor for dysfunctional government. Mish, what do you think?
I think you're on to something there. And interestingly enough, just a few days ago, I did a search. Is there anything called the rule of progress? And there wasn't, so I got to claim it. Mish's rule of progress, it's politicians like to cite progress no matter how ludicrous the claim or which side of the aisle they occupy. Opposing claims of progress are the norm. Now, what inspired that thought was the federal government. Donald Trump called a meeting on Tuesday, and he got all the Republican senators together. And he said, we're going to hammer out the details of this arrangement, and then the Senate's going to approve it. Well, heading into the meeting, Jason, there were four Republican senators against this. Now, any more than two against it, and it can't pass. After the meeting, seven were against it, but Senator Mitch McConnell goes out there and says, we made progress. And I'm sitting there thinking, wow, progress. That is really cool. Any observations on that? Because I've got some more coming up here on Illinois.
Yeah, well, I think that's pretty good. It's pretty telling. And everyone listening, I'm sure, who has half a brain is in agreement with you. And, you know, it's sort of like all the, I'm sure, what is it, Rafael Castro, you know, Fidel's brother, mm-hmm. who's now running Cuba, and Kim Jong-un in North Korea, and Maduro, the guy in Venezuela, as the country's falling apart. I'm sure they all get up and talk about the wonderful progress they're making.
Progress they've been making, yes, absolutely.
And, folks, lesson here is we got to stop believing these frickin' idiots, okay? Now, look, I don't know about you folks, and I was very involved in, you'll never imagine this, listeners, that I was very political in my old days, in my youth. You know, I was really interested in politics. And, you know, now that I look back on it, all those people in the political sphere, they were really kind of these, like, mostly, not all of them, but most of them, were kind of these, like, dorky guys who couldn't get a date, who sort of really were kind of like not that motivated and weren't doing much in life. And they were kind of like really Bernie Sanders was until he got into office. He was a loser. Okay. You know, he was just kind of living off welfare and, you know, floating from job to job occasionally. And why is it that we give these people any real degree of credibility? It's beyond me. Maybe it's because they're on TV all the time. That doesn't mean they're smart. And it doesn't mean they really have any real right to govern us. You know, the founding fathers, their whole idea of government was that it would be part-time, that these people would function in the real economy. They would have businesses and they would come and serve for a short time and then go back to their district and run their business, right? Or do their job. But it's, you know, now they're career politicians. It's a mess.
But public service means serving themselves.
Of course.
Let's get on to the real economy. But first we have to discuss progress, Illinois style. You know, we did just meet in Chicago. So it will be appropriate to talk about Illinois. Illinois has been without a budget 2 years, Jason. Its bonds are one step above junk.
It's a mess. Those public workers.
Lowest in the nation.
Yep.
The rating agencies are threatening to downgrade this thing to junk unless Illinois agrees to do something about it. Yeah. On June 15th, Governor Bruce Rauner called a special 10-day legislative session to finalize the budget. We are into the eighth day of that session. The session is costing Illinois taxpayers $50,000 a day. The longest session we've had so far is 23 minutes. They've ranged from 10 minutes to 23 minutes. But, Jason, I'm pleased to announce we made progress yesterday.
Of course.
My sources tell me by an 84-0 vote, part of Interstate 55 will be renamed the Obama Expressway. That is the entirety of the progress that's been made.
Oh, my God. Folks, you can't make this stuff up. But really, Mish, it's fair to ask, is Illinois really any worse than a whole bunch of municipalities around the country? Is it any worse than Japan and its lopsided massive amount of debt? And, you know, I would short lots of municipalities. I would short Japan if I thought they weren't just going to get a bailout. They're just going to get a bailout. I mean, California is a dysfunctional mess in so many ways. All these states and cities and countries, I mean, around the world, it's just a house of, the whole planet is a house of cards.
Every state is following the Bernie Sanders model. Those are the states that are in the worst shape. But yeah, even some states outside of that, even pension plans in Texas are an absolute disaster case. There's lawsuits flying in Dallas right now over the Dallas Police and Fire Fund. You know, all of these municipalities that made huge, huge promises to police and fire districts are finding they've got more retirees than they've got police officers, and they don't know what to do about it.
And you know what? In the Socialist Republic of California, there are retired lifeguards who are in their just late 40s. They're not that old. Mm-hmm. And they're making between $200,000 and $400,000 a year because they have like multiple pensions. They figured out how to play the game. Big government is a disaster everywhere it's found. Okay, if you want one answer to the problem, shrink the size of government. The bigger the government,
absolutely,
the bigger the government, the smaller the citizen. That's the rule of the world. It's always that way. Always, always, always. Hey, Mish, let's talk about the stock market. I mean, you know, the stock market's been on a tear since the Trump election. Is this a bubble?
Of course it's a bubble. How big it going to get before it pops? You know, I don't know. This is what we talked about when I gave my presentation. It was on sentiment, valuation, and timing. Where are we? Where we're headed? Is now a good time to buy? I asked the question. I said, is now a good time to buy? And a couple of people said no, and a couple of people looked like they wanted to say yes. One person there, I'm not sure who that was, but he goes, says, a good time to buy what? That's exactly the question, because
good,
you know,
question.
Everyone's rushing to buy everything. The stock market, you know, the FANG stocks, Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Netflix, Google, Goldman Sachs, which is a huge contrarian indicator, you know, came out, and David Kossin said, even in a sluggish market, these FANG stocks can't do any wrong. And I'm sitting here, and I'm looking here. One could have bought Amazon for $5 in 2002. It's now $1,000 or so. And we're talking about what a great buy this thing is. At the presentation, I discussed the Shiller PE ratio, which is
that's what I want to ask you about. This is
PE ratio.
Okay, so Mish, this is slide number 7, and this is the most fascinating slide in your presentation, if you ask me, because you go back to like 1880 and on up to present day. And you have tracked, you know, Black Tuesday in 1929, the Great Depression, the dot-com bubble in 2000, you know, give or take, then the housing bubble, and then the nearly everything bubble and the Great Recession. Tell us about this chart, the Shiller P.E. ratio chart.
The Shiller P.E. ratio is just 10-year smooth P.E.s and an average of the stock market PEs over the last 10 years. The S&P 500 wasn't an S&P 500 back in the 1900s. It was the Dow. So the idea behind this is after a crash, you know, or during a crash, PEs look high because companies don't have a lot of earnings. At the height of a bubble, earnings always look great right before the crash. So the idea behind this is to just take all the PEs for the last 10 years, average them together and see what you have. We're in what I call the nearly everything bubble right now. And the Shiller PE is right about where it was on Black Tuesday in 1929. The dot-com bubble was the only bigger bubble, but dot-com bubble had its own peculiarities because during the dot-com bubble, there were still a lot of stocks out there, oil-related stocks, energy stocks. There were actually exceptionally good buys, but technology had overruled things such that, you know, the average PE was out of sight. So on a median PE basis, we're at the worst ever. And on a market cap to GDP basis, which was another slide I presented, 9 and 10, it's called the Buffett indicator. What Warren Buffett likes to measure is the value of corporate equities to GDP. So the chart I posted is actually a little bit old. I believe we're at an all-time high here on the basis of the Buffett indicator, taking out 2000, if my understanding is correct. So this is what we're talking about here. John Hussman, who's an economist and a fund manager, he's estimating 1% total returns, not 1% a year for the next 12 years. There's various other people that are forecasting negative real returns for 7 or 8 years. I'm in that group, but let's say we have not negative returns or flat returns. Let's say we have returns of a modest 3 or 4% a year, okay, going forward. The problem is pension plans have assumed going forward 7 and 8% a year. Analysis in my hands right now says that if Illinois Police Pension Fund gets 5% returns, you know, going forward, they're going to be bankrupt, busted by 2021. I think 5% returns, highly optimistic from where we're at here right now.
Mish, I mean, you could even talk about this in the broader context of Social Security or any government entitlement. I've had Lawrence Kutlikoff on the show a couple of times. I'm sure you're very familiar with his work. And he's done maybe the most research into the what I used to call the $60 trillion time bomb. And he calls it basically a $220 trillion time bomb. And this is the entitlements, much like all these pension plans all over the country that are really bust and they just haven't announced it formally yet. But I think they're just going to all get Keynesian bailouts anyway. I mean, the government's just going to print money and the feds will bail them out. I mean, right? I mean, that's what will happen.
It hasn't helped. All it's done, Jason, is inflated the stock market. We're back in another housing bubble.
I'm not talking about general Keynesianism. I'm not talking about Federal Reserve Keynesianism. I'm talking about specific bailouts for these particular affected parties. So, you know, the various pensions plans and the various municipalities, that's what I'm talking about, is bailouts specific, just earmarked for them only.
Oh, absolutely. And that makes matters worse for the average guy. Because why? The average guy doesn't get a bailout. And people are angry. That's what the last election was all about. People couldn't fathom Trump winning, despite amazingly horrid ratings. The thing is, Hillary had amazingly horrid ratings, too, and one of them had to win mathematically. So that's what we're talking about here, and it's what the Fed does. Treasury Secretary Paulson went before Congress in the most recent great financial crisis and said, well, we need money, and we're going to get it to the people, and we're going to do this and that. Guess what? As soon as he got approval for that, he gave it to the banks. Gave it to the banks, bailed out the banks. That's what's going to come. Going to bail out the pension plans. What does that do to the average guy? Nothing. Still mired in debt. Still stuck in a hole.
Yeah.
What happens when the average person gets mad and decides, we've seen a taste of it. It's what got Trump elected. What happens when the average guy gets elected and a socialist gets in there and just says free money for everyone? That's what's coming.
Yeah, it's never an equal distribution. It always favors some. And, you know, what can you do? It's the way of the world, right? So what should people be doing now? I mean, you know, are you going to say that people should buy gold? Or, you know, what's the Ms. Shedlock thinking?
Well, that's my thesis. And I also said something at the conference that I'm willing to repeat here. I said, you have to admit your own mistakes or someone else will admit them for you. I've been bullish on gold. I've always been bullish on gold, but on and off to varying degrees. It hasn't played out exactly like I thought. Instead, we're seeing some weird things here going on with cryptocurrencies, Bitcoin, and a whole, you know, consortium of things that are now absolutely going to the moon. But liquidity is going to find a home. It's just guessing where that home is going to be. Certainly, the Fed, central banks in general, Bank of Japan, ECB, more than anything, has helped prop up the global financial markets. And I also posted a slide at the conference. It was about when does gold do well and when does gold do poorly. And it's not really what people think. People think that a rising interest rates are bad for gold. That's not necessarily true. I posted a chart. People say that a falling dollar is good for gold. Well, that's not necessarily true. It's falling now. We've seen periods where the gold has risen, mainly in 2005, and the dollar rose right along with it. But gold is really a measure of faith in central banks that they have everything under control. And gold topped around 1923, pretty much back in 2011, 2012. Europe was in a crisis. Everyone was worried about Greece leaving the Union, the European Union busting up. ECB President Mario Draghi came out and said, we will do whatever it takes to save the euro, and believe me, it'll be enough. Guess what? He didn't really do anything for a couple of years later when he started quantitative easing, matching Bernanke and the Fed. But that statement alone gave confidence that the central banks of the world had everything under control. My belief is we're going to have another question here, whether or not central banks really have things under control. And an interesting comment, Janet Yellen just the other day said, I don't believe we're going to have another crisis in our lifetimes. She didn't define the term our lifetimes. And I saw various.
Yeah, let me guess. Janet Yellen knows that she has a terminal disease. She's going to leave the Fed when her term's up real soon. She's going to pass away 3 months later, and then there will be a crash. I mean, this is just a ridiculous statement from her. I mean, well,
it's
ridiculous.
It's a totally ludicrous statement. And I forget who it was, so I won't put a name to it. But one of the reports I said changed the word our lifetimes to her lifetime. I suppose that would make more sense, but that doesn't hold true in the context. Meanwhile, the Fed governor from Minnesota last November said at a 66.7% probability that there's going to be another crisis, but he used in this century. Well, good grief, that's, 80 years? So these are all meaningless statements, but at least he's on the right side of things. I don't believe I'm going to live throughout this next century, Jason. I'm willing to bet, unless I go quickly, that there's going to be another crisis in my lifetime. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, this is just crazy. You can't make this stuff up. One of the interesting things that I used to talk about, Mish, and we've got to wrap it up here fairly soon, but Jeremy Siegel, along with Michael Milken, wrote an article, and this was several years ago. I want to say maybe 11, 12 years ago. They talked about the looming asset shortage. And I thought this was very interesting because, you know, when we look at inflation, nobody really talks about the fact that asset inflation has occurred so much so that it has really priced people out of the investor class, whether it be stocks or real estate or other assets. If you're sort of in the lower middle class now, a lot of those people will never really get in what I call the investor class. And of course, the investor class is where you can get on the faster track to wealth creation and really move up in the world. Yeah, it may take 5, 10, 15 years, but you can do it. Okay. No one counts this in the consumer price index, right? So a lot of people are really left behind, but it takes many years for that to play out. And when you kind of compare and contrast that with all of the statements from Yellen, and then you look at that Jeremy Siegel, Michael Milken thing, where they said that, you know, the world population is growing, globalization has lifted 300 million people out of poverty, and we talk about the rising billion that will soon have access to the internet, and they're actually getting smartphones and stuff like that now, you know, cheap smartphones in all sorts of developing countries. And this is going to bring new money into the marketplace, right? New customers for companies. Granted, they may only have a small amount of money, but they have some money and their numbers are so large that, I don't know, you know, maybe there's a real reason for some optimism. Am I crazy?
Global standards of living are certainly rising, and they would rise a lot more were it not for the Fed and central banks in general insisting upon 2% inflation. Here we have 2%, well, it's less than 2% by what they measure. If you look at the inflated prices of assets, one could make a claim that it's 5, 7, 8%. You know, who knows? The Fed does not count housing prices in the CPI. Instead, they've got owner's equivalent rent, which is a measure of actual real rents. It's also a measure, and this is really phenomenal here. They do a survey. And they ask people what they would rent their own houses from if they were to rent their own house from themselves. This is called owner's equivalent rent. And part of that answer actually goes into the CPI. So it's crazy. They miss the asset inflation. In blowing these bubbles, insisting upon inflation of 2% in a deflationary world. And let's face it, prices going down means that they're more affordable and standards of living are rising, but now they're rising outside of the U.S. because central banks are insisting upon 2% inflation and wages are not keeping up. The average guy is priced out of being able to buy a home, and buying a home isn't that great of an investment, especially at the peak of bubbles. Now, if you're buying them and renting them out and have rent income coming in, that's a different aspect. That's one of the things that you guys focus on. Income-producing assets are still going to produce income. And what you don't want to do is be leveraged in debt, and that's what happens to the average guy at the peak of every cycle. It happened in 2005 and 6 when credit standards were loosened such to the average guy could buy right at the top. Massive transfer of wealth from the poor to the wealthy. And then guess who was bailed out? The bondholders and the banks, the already wealthy, and they act as if they deserve this. Extremely galling, Jason.
Yeah, it really is amazing. I don't know, for my money, I think you just got to be conservative. You got to be in those linear real estate markets, the ones that nobody's really talking that much about. They're not headlining the news. You know, a $51 million, get this, 6,000 square foot condo in Manhattan just got foreclosed on recently. And can you imagine a condo that cost $8,500 per square foot? If we're not in a bubble in these cyclical high-end markets, I mean, when were we ever in a bubble if we're not in one now? This is beyond ridiculous. But it does show you that there's been a big concentration of wealth at the high end. And these economic policies make the rich a lot richer, don't they? Because they can borrow money at almost nothing, basically negative interest rates or near negative interest rates. They can really accelerate their wealth creation, can't they?
Absolutely. I think the key word here right now is patience. Certainly, one could have made money in the last few years, but nothing like what one could have made in 2009. So the question is, do you want to be throwing your money at assets here in 2017, or is there a better opportunity coming? This is where I said you have to admit mistakes. The assets have gone up the last 3 years. I didn't think they would, but they have. The question is, what do you do about it? Do you say, let's join the party now? Or do you say, there's a better opportunity coming up? And that's what I would say. That would be my recommendation. Wait for a better opportunity. Even if prices go up from here, I'm convinced you'll be able to buy them back at cheaper prices later.
Excellent points, Mitch. And, you know, I just think the conservative assets, though, are the place to be. I mean, you got to be investing somewhere. You're a stock market guy. I mean, is the whole stock market a bubble? Is it time to short the S&P? You know, is that something to do?
Shorts get carried out a lot of times. And the other mistake shorts make is tend to buy back too early, getting caught up thinking that bargains are there. Patience, you know, kind of really means that. And we bought in 2009, didn't stay long enough, you know, and I'm looking here now. You have to judge various things. What's going to happen when the bubble blows? I like gold here. I would recommend certainly if people have a percentage of their assets in gold. One really never knows what's going to happen here. If nothing else, have it for an insurance policy, because I think it's a good insurance policy. There's really nothing wrong with having a lot of cash on the sidelines, hoping to buy up assets on the cheap. I think another opportunity to do that is coming. We had one in 2002, 2003. We had one in 2009, 2010.
When you quote those years, you're talking about stock market bubbles, crashes, obviously, because, you know, the dot-com crash. And yeah.
Yes, certainly housing was a very good buy in 2000. The stock market wasn't. But what do you do in an everything bubble, which is where I think we are now? So that's my perspective here, Jason.
Very interesting stuff. Mish, give out your website. You've got a blog with a lot of in-depth analysis. It's quite interesting to read.
MitchTalk.com is my economics blog. I've also got a photography blog out there, and I would really like people to take a look at that. That's MishMoments.com. Rather than just post random pictures here or there, I take people around a place. This is what you can do in a week or two at one site. Took people around Iceland in 16 days. I'm now on Zion National Park. I think I might do Death Valley next, or maybe Prague. I've got a lot of material out there, so check it out. And it's not just pretty pictures. I give tips on how to take great shots.
Good stuff. Mish Shedlock, thanks for joining us.
A pleasure to be back on, Jason. Hey, we can't wait another year or two to do another one.
Yes, and it was great having you at the Venture Alliance Mastermind, too. Good talking to you.
Thanks, Jason.
Thank you so much for listening. Be sure to check out HartmanMedia.com for appropriate disclaimers and terms of service. Remember that guest opinions are their own, and if you require specific legal or tax advice or advice in any other specialized area, please consult an appropriate professional. We look forward to seeing you on the next episode.